Hello, and welcome back to the Dive and Dig podcast. My name's Lucy Blue, and this week we are travelling with Dr. Bob Holzman to South America. Over the last few years, Bob spent time with a small community in a swamp in Guyana, studying what all boat nerds adore, dugout canoes. So let's find out what Bob found in this watery environment. So, Bob, it's really good. It's great to talk to you. We've known each other for quite some years now. And having sort of been involved with your research for your PhD, which is what we're going to talk about today, I've just found this subject so fascinating. And I thought it would be really lovely to share your experiences in Guyana, living in this sort of remote places with this community, with the Dive and Dig audience, and I hope they'll enjoy it as much as I have. So maybe you could just tell me a little bit about you and why you decided to do this research.
Sure. Delighted to be here with you today, Lucy. My interest in Guyana started out as an interest in dugout canoes or logboats, and I'll probably use the words interchangeably. The idea that they are still in use throughout much of the tropical world today fascinated me, and I wondered, what is it about this technology that has allowed it to persist for so many thousands of years? I was also concerned about the continued persistence of it. Traditional boats are going out of use in some areas of the world, and I thought it was important to document the use of logboats in a traditional community before that use changes too much.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this is a big challenge, actually, that we face as maritime archaeologists or ethnographers, is documenting these amazing vessels before they die off, essentially. But how did you... I mean, I get your love for logboats because I also share that passion, but how did you pick on this particular community in Guyana? What was... I mean, because, okay, they're dying out, but there's still a fair selection to choose from.
Yes, they are used throughout Guyana in indigenous communities. First, I started just with online searches and literature searches to find out what I could about where they are being used now. Then I went to Guyana on a scouting expedition, so to speak, and started talking to people and meeting people who are involved in Amerindian, that is American Indian affairs, speaking with people who are associated with charities or not-for-profits, and getting ideas about what communities logboats are still in really intensive use. I wanted to document their use in a village where they're part of everyday life. And I started getting recommendations, and I traveled around Guyana and visited some of these, all of them on the north coast, the ones that I had visited. When I visited Imbotero, it was immediately clear that it was going to be a productive place to do research if the community was willing to accept my presence there.
No, of course, because you need their buy-in, don't you? But so when you say they're part of everyday life, what does that conjure up? I mean, what are they using these logboats for?
Imbotero is an interesting community. It is located entirely within a swamp. It's in an area of mangrove swamp. The places that people live, where they have built their homes, have been cleared from mangrove bush. As a swamp, what's called a permanently inundated swamp, it's below maximum high tide, and the land floods twice a day with the high tide. So the homes are all built on stilts or piles, and when the tide comes in, the homes are above a certain amount of shallow water. If you want to visit your next-door neighbor, much less go to your farm or collect resources in the forest, you're going to need a boat of some sort. Even when the tide is out and the land is exposed, it's still soft and wet, and you're likely to sink into the mud down to your knees. It's very difficult to walk anywhere, and so boats are literally essential to almost every activity in the village.
Wow, that's amazing, isn't it? To think that you can't even go outside your front door without jumping into a boat, although it has a certain appeal. So what, I mean, how many people lived in this community? How do you communicate with them? You went for quite some time, didn't you? I mean, it was weeks, if not months, if I remember.
I was, aside from the scouting expedition, I was there for two field seasons. First one was about 8 weeks, the second one was about 2 weeks. The village is about 450, 475 people. Guyana is an English-speaking country. Many of the people in Imbotero do speak the indigenous language, which is Warao, and the people who live there are the Warao people. But almost everyone is fluent in English, speaks English on an everyday basis, and the use of the Warao language is actually declining with time.
I would imagine this community is not exactly next to a highway. Are people coming regularly to come and observe and watch? And I guess you were talking with people, interviewing people, asking them about their use of the boat. I mean, it must have been quite an unusual thing for the community to have Bob there, let alone for Bob to go and stay with this community.
The community is not very well connected with the outside world. It's about a half an hour by motorboat to the nearest village where there are shops and where one can get a ferry or a small plane to go to the capital of Georgetown. I was the first resident researcher at the Imbotero Research Center, which sounds a bit more grand than it really is. It's not a research center with research facilities per se. It's really a guest house that has been established by the Guyana Marine Conservation Society in order to host researchers and promote research in the area.
So how does it work? Does everybody have a boat? Is it a boat per family? Is there a school in the village? Do the kids, how do they have to go on boats to, how do these boats function in a sort of more visceral way?
Literally every family, every household has at least one dugout canoe. Several have more than one, and there are perhaps half a dozen, maybe 10 power boats in the community as well. Some of those are dugout canoes with engines attached. Some of them are a local kind of speedboat called a balahu. And if when people need to go to the nearest village, a half hour or more away, they tend to prefer to use the power boats if they have access to them. Many people do not. The households, the families that have only canoes, use them for essentially everything that they need to do within the village. I already mentioned that if you want to visit your next door neighbor, you do that. On the Barima River, which is adjacent to the village, there is a tiny grocery shop, and people will take their canoes out of Imbotero Creek onto the river to visit the grocery. Especially, they use their canoes for economic purposes. There are two main types of economic activity in the village. The first is farming. There are small farms, just a hectare or two, or say 2 to 5 acres at most. And these are on polders, areas that have been drained in order to make farming possible. The other main economic activity is gathering things from the forest, the surrounding forest, especially land crabs, which are a major form of protein that is gathered. People are in the forest every day gathering firewood, palm leaves to roof their homes. Fishing is the other major economic activity. People fish within the swamp, and they also fish on the river. They use probably half a dozen different methods of fishing, depending on exactly where in the swamp they are, whether they're fishing in one of the small streamlets or the creek, or if they've managed to force their way across the muddy ground and through the tangled mangroves, and they get to an area where the water is slightly fresher. There are different fish who live there, and they'll fish with a hook and line.
Where do they build these boats? Where do they get the timber from, and who's building them?
They build the boats in the forest right around where they live. The timber is from forest trees in the swamp forest. They use a pretty broad variety of trees, most of which have been used for generations or centuries, and the people are very familiar with the different qualities of the trees, how durable they're going to be, how difficult it is to carve them. There are perhaps 10 or 12 people who still build boats in the village. Among the Waro people, building canoes used to be something that every adult male would do. That's no longer the case, and there's only perhaps a dozen adult men who still build canoes in the village. It seems to be enough to keep the village supplied with their needs for canoes. The construction was fascinating to watch.
So you watched them building them then? Oh, cool.
I watched one canoe being built from start to finish, and watched a number of other canoes, just certain stages of the construction.
So what's the size of these canoes?
They vary. Some are as little as perhaps 3, 3.5 meters long, and the biggest are about 10 meters. And for a small canoe, a dedicated worker with a few helpers can build it in under a week. For one of the big ones, an 8 or 10 meter canoe, you're going to be talking well over a month. The builders now, many of them use chainsaws to fell the tree and to do most of the rough shaping and to remove most of the wood from the inside of the trunk. After that, they use hand tools, axes and adzes. And people who do not have access to a chainsaw will do the whole thing with hand tools. They'll fell the tree with an axe, do all of the shaping with an axe and an adze, and then maybe some fine shaping with a what they call a cutlass, which we would call a machete.
Oh, that's amazing. And it is beautiful actually to watch skilled artists, like, when they're crafting the boats. It is a real, I don't know, craftsmanship in a way, isn't it? It's amazing how they manage to get the right width and thickness and shape, and just using their eye and their knowledge, really.
The level of skill is very impressive. The one that I watched under construction ended up with a very nicely smooth finish. The sides were perhaps 3 centimeters wide. The bottom was perhaps 3 centimeters thick, not wide, and very, very regular, very nicely shaped. No use of measuring devices, all by eye, to determine how much to continue thinning the boat until it was the right thickness. It was done by feel. The builder would put his hands on both sides of the side of the boat, maybe slap both sides of the boat or tap it with a tool to get the sound of it. He had to get the thickness very regular because one of the last stages of construction involves expanding the boat, placing the canoe over live fire. So the wood becomes hot. That basically boils the water inside the cells of the wood. The wood becomes soft, and then the sides are spread apart using short poles of wood. And the builder that I observed told me that if the thickness of the canoe is not consistent all the way through, it will split. in the process of expansion.
That's
I watched it.
amazing.
It did not split. This was a very experienced builder who is, he was about 40. He's been building since he was 14, and he's built dozens of boats. Just a wonderful thing to observe that level of skill using such basic, simple tools to produce something that was really quite beautiful and functional.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And so you say that now there are only this handful of people that are building. Did you, I mean, you visited two or three times, I guess, overall. Do you notice things changing? Do you think, I mean, my experience when I've gone and documented boats in different parts of the world is that those skills are not necessarily being passed on to the next generation. The next generation wants to, you know, be an engineer or a doctor or something. Are you witnessing change in Umbertero or Imbertero, sorry.
Yes, that process is observable in Imbotero. Very few of the young people are interested in learning how to build canoes. Almost all of the young people I spoke with expect that canoes will continue to be important in the village's everyday life. Everyone that I spoke to, every young person I spoke to, wants to own a powerboat. Many of them do not want to tend farms like their parents do, and they want to become teachers, they want to work in forestry or mining. Many of them want to leave the village, work in commercial fishing. You are seeing the beginning of technological incursions in the village. Some people have mobile phones. The mobile reception is very poor, and you can't always get a signal, but a surprising number of people do have them. There is a public school that's funded by the national government, so all the children attend. It's required that they attend. So they are becoming more and more familiar with the world outside the village, with modern life, with understanding the national polity and the national economics. And many of them are tending away from traditional ways of life.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, isn't it? I mean, and who can blame them? You know, they want access to their own money in their pocket, and the sort of, I mean, it's a hard life, isn't it? So you can understand why, but it does mean, well, I mean, I guess that underpins even more how important the work that you've just been doing is, because you've documented, you know, the whole breadth of activity and the build and, you know, every aspect of life in the swamp with these lovely little boats. So I presume, were you paddling around every day as well, or did you have somebody paddling?
I did my own paddling. I've been a canoeist for many years, and so as soon as I arrived, I rented a small dugout canoe from someone in the village, and I kept it the whole time that I was there. A little less stable than a typical European or North American canoe, and it took me a little while to get used to, but pretty much the same kind of thing to paddle. And I enjoyed it. And if I wanted to go anywhere at all in the village, just like everyone else, I had to do it by canoe.
So do you think that they, what did the locals think of this? Not only does Dr. Bob turn up, but he's also paddling around with the rest, you know, with the best of them. Was there any element of competition? Were they wanting to race with you, or?
I couldn't say I was paddling with the best of them. My skills were nowhere near the level of skill that even children in the village have. Everyone from the age of 4 or 5 years old is a competent canoeist. 4 or 5 year old children are paddling their canoes by themselves, and they're far more competent at it than I am. They found my efforts, I think, a little amusing, but I think people were pleased that I was trying, and I think I was given a certain amount of respect for that.
Yeah, I'm sure you're just being modest, but well, it sounds amazing, Bob. Are you planning to go back?
I am. I hope to go back within the next few months. I want to see what has changed there. I want to continue to engage with the people of Imbotero. They were hugely hospitable and welcoming to me and helpful throughout my time there. I want to go back and see if there's some way that I can return the favor. I hope that I can be useful to the village in some way. I also need to deliver a copy of my thesis to the people there, who certainly deserve to see what I have written about them.
Absolutely. No, that's absolutely best practice. I think it's really amazing. Well, I wish you luck with your return and seeing your friends again in Imbotero, and good luck with the rest of the research as well. So, and thank you so much for talking to me today, because it's just, you've painted this magical picture of a fastly, unfortunately disappearing world, I fear. But let's see when you come back how change has affected again. Just fascinating. I feel like I was there with Bob paddling through the waterways of Imbotero. I particularly love the description of building the log boats, the skill and expertise applied. But as Bob says, things are changing quite rapidly. Thankfully, though, he has documented the life of these small boats in his PhD from the University of Southampton, which he plans to publish. So thanks again to Dr. Bob and to you for listening to the Dive and Dig podcast, brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that supports research into maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. Until next time, take care.